Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the relationship between Iran and the United States. The U.S. and Iran have not had normal diplomatic relations now in 27 years. And in recent years, the relationship has been particularly tense, going back to 2002, when in his State of the Union address, President Bush said that Iran was part of an axis of evil. The United States has blamed Iran for the spread of terrorism, has also charged that the government of Iran has been secretly working to produce nuclear weapons. Now, at the same time, it's undeniable that, particularly in recent years, Iran has been one of the most powerful, influential countries in the Middle East. And a lot of people in the foreign policy community believe that in order to bring stability to Iraq, there will have to be Iranian cooperation, and that will mean that the United States will have to sit down and talk with Iran and see if it's possible to work out our differences. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with someone who has had a long career in the Foreign Service and has had a couple of postings, in fact, in Iran. Our guest is Ambassador William G. Miller. He's a senior policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and he also heads the Iran Project at Search for Common Ground. He has had a number of positions in the Foreign Service and also in Washington. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine from 1993 until 1998. He served as political officer for the U.S. Embassy in Tehran from 1962 until 1964, and also at the U.S. Consulate in Isfahan, Iran, from 1959 until 1962. He spent 15 years on Capitol Hill, where he served as staff director for three different Senate committees, including the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And as I mentioned, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Search for Common Ground Iran project, but this is a project that basically is working to try to improve the relations between the two countries by working on exchanges between Americans and Iranians. More on this in just a moment. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, they're welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just are brief so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible, keep the program moving, but anybody's welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ambassador Miller, hello.
Hello. How are you, David?
I am fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Good.
Good. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Perhaps you might want to talk for just a moment about the Search for Common Ground Iran project and what it's all about.
Well, this project really is aimed at developing people-to-people relationships between Iran and the United States at every level possible. The first exchange took place actually in 1998, and this was between Olympic wrestlers of the United States and Iran. They had competed against each other in the Olympics, and there was a match in Tehran between people who had wrestled with each other in the Olympics. And this was before a huge crowd. Americans won in some cases, Iranians in the other, but in all cases, the victories were cheered, and the American flag, when the American wrestler won, was paraded around the stadium to the applause of the audience. Certainly at the level of wrestling, on a level playing field, you might say, there was no problem. We've had exchanges of environmental lawyers from the universities in Iran and our best universities in the United States that have programs in environmental law. We've had film festivals. The Iranian filmmakers are among the world's best. Art exhibits, exchanges of clergy, Christians, rabbis, and Islamic leaders have met together on religious principles that they share. And there have been meetings of poets, and most importantly, from the point of view of international relations, political scientists, and on the particular question of nuclear issues, nuclear physicists from both the United States and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a program that's really aimed at filling the gap, this vacuum of contact between Iran and the United States, which has hurt us, hurt both nations very badly.
Before we go on to talk about some of the various issues in detail, let me ask you the big bottom line question. Do you believe that it is possible for the United States and Iran to resolve their differences and to establish, sometime in the reasonable future, to establish normal diplomatic relations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give you some reasons why I think so. For the period 1950 until the Iranian Revolution, 1979, there were more Iranian students in the United States at our institutions of higher learning than any other foreign country. And Iran's government, its military, its scientific establishment, is filled with people who have been educated in the United States. There is a very strong understanding on the part of many in Iran, far more in Iran than Americans about Iran, because of their experience at American universities and living in American cities and towns. That reservoir of goodwill and understanding and respect for our accomplishments is the basis for why I think we can have good relations.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly a desire on their part to have normal relations with us. I'd say the difficulty has been getting over the self-imposed isolation that both countries created in 1979. But at every level other than government, that is, at the professional levels of medicine, of the arts, education, religion, there has been considerable contact. It's only our governments that know very little about each other.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the Iranian side, there are many in the government who know a lot about the United States because they were educated here.
There are a number of points that I want to talk about, and a number of places where there has been tension between the two governments. Let me ask you about one of them, and that is the assertion that the United States has made that the government of Iran is interested in developing nuclear weapons. On the Iranian side, they have said in a formal public way, they have said, no, we're not interested in developing nuclear weapons. What we're interested in is developing an infrastructure so that we can use nuclear power for energy generation. They say this is for peaceful uses. It's not for military uses. And that has seemed to be the standoff. The U.S. says we think that they're building bombs or that they want to build bombs. The Iranians say no. We're only interested in peaceful, as any nation is entitled to do, develop nuclear power for peaceful uses. Do you think that, in fact, the government of Iran, the current government of Iran, is interested in developing nuclear weapons, or is it, as they say, they're just purely interested in developing nuclear energy?
This is a complicated question. Iran, as a major nation in the Middle East, the population is 70 million with a highly educated public, has had a nuclear program since the 50s. And this program really began with our assistance and even urging. This was Atoms for Peace under President Eisenhower. And we developed with Iran a program for Iran's energy needs, which was a comprehensive look at its oil and gas resources, its hydro, and other forms of energy generation, and nuclear. And from the earliest time, late 50s, early 60s, the plan was to have Iran build 22 reactors, nuclear reactors, and they were to be of American design. And in fact, the plant at Bushehr originally was an American design, and in its essence it still is, even though it's gone through several permutations of builders because of the politics. From the beginning, because there was a critical mass of nuclear physicists and engineers, almost all of whom were educated in the United States, as in the United States, where there were those who said it should only be for peaceful uses, there were others who said you need it, you need to develop nuclear weapons for a deterrent, given the dangerous part of the world that Iran is located in, with Russia having nuclear weapons, with Pakistan, with India, with Israel, and of course the United States, that it was necessary for a major power in the region to have nuclear weapons. So this is one school of thought, but it has always been, and it remains to this day, a minority position. You might say they're the nuclear hawks. Certainly, many of the elements of a nuclear energy program could be used to develop fissile material for nuclear weapons. And this is the concern of those in the world of nuclear proliferation, that there could be perhaps secret programs that in a breakout could result in nuclear weapons being developed. But as of now, they do not have nuclear weapons. Their declaratory policy and religious doctrine says that nuclear weapons are immoral and un-Islamic and contrary to the interests of Iran. They have a right to develop nuclear energy. As a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, those nuclear power nations, such as ours, are obliged under the treaty to assist Iran to develop nuclear energy. And of course, there's a conflict there. And the international community is obliged under the terms of the NPT to assist them in their efforts. The issue, as we know, is there have been charges of violations. There have been violations. The IAEA has been involved in Iran extensively and is trying to work out some way out of the impasse. And the impasse centers on the issue of the production of nuclear material for use in power reactors. We say, the United States and some of the European states, that Iran should not have its own indigenous production facility. The Iranians say that under the treaty, they asked for nuclear material. They were denied it in violation of the treaty, and they had to develop their own indigenous nuclear energy production facilities. So that's the crux of the matter. There have been negotiations through the Europeans and, of course, with the International Atomic Energy Agency. And these negotiations have been going on for a number of years, but the missing element is the United States. And on the outside, the United States' position is that Iran should not be permitted to develop its own indigenous nuclear energy materials. That's the heart of the matter. And certainly in a face-to-face negotiation, these issues could be resolved because there are solutions that there are many innovative ideas that are out there that get beyond the impasse, which is we have a right on the, which is the assertion on the part of the Iranians, to the U.S. position, which is that they should be prevented from exercising their right because they're a rogue state.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller to bring into the conversation. The guest is Ambassador William Miller. He currently is a senior policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 1993 until 1998. He also had a couple of posts in Iran. He served as the political officer for the embassy in Tehran from 1962 until 1964, and before that at the U.S. consulate in Isfahan, Iran. He's joining us by telephone. We're talking about Iran and the relationship between Iran and the United States, and questions are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's bring in the caller here, our first in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I appreciate your emphasis on, what should I say, cross-national exchanges and so forth. But I think there's another side that we need, that at least I would like to hear you address about Iran, and that has to do with Iran's sponsor, we'll call it in general, sponsorship of terrorist activities. And I'll start with two. One, the Khobar Towers bombing and their relationship to that. Two, their relationship to the, which was in 1996, and in 1994, their relationship to the bombing in Argentina of in Buenos Aires of a Jewish center, which just recently the Argentinian prosecutors have indicted in a number of former Iranian government officials, including former President Rafsanjani. Now, in addition to that, and this is past, currently we have just a number of activities by the Islamic Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which reports have shown that they have up to 20 terrorist camps and centers, and even more recently, under they have a think tank called the Doctrinal Analysis Center for Security Without Borders, which has even been talking about the general use of suicide terrorism by some of these groups that they're training. They've actually had papers, etc. Now, all this information is something that I think we cannot leave out and cannot disregard if we're going to talk about what Iran is doing in the world, in the Middle East and elsewhere. I mean, I won't even begin talking about Hezbollah and all the proxy activities that Iran is involved with there and in Somalia. But I think all of that needs to be addressed, and not just focusing on what I would call the worthy and nice but not very effective cross-border relationships. So I'd like to hear you address that.
Yeah. Well, no, this is a very pertinent issue that you raise. And certainly in the past, the charges and the realities that Iran has been involved in what we call terrorist activities is the case. Under President Khatami, the president before the present president, there were rigorous steps that were taken to curb and eliminate certainly as much of the units that were involved in those terrorist activities in the past. Iran's revolution from 1979 has gone through various stages of extreme violence to moderation, to reform and counter-reform. And it's still a very dynamic, turbulent society. But the best way, certainly as someone who has spent a lifetime in conflict resolution and diplomacy, negotiation, to deal with these tough questions of stopping issues of terrorism, for example, or dealing with the possibility of clandestine nuclear weapons production, is to negotiate face-to-face, talk these things through, use all of the means that we've developed over many centuries and thousands of years of settling disputes. And it's an absolute mistake to not face each other, to deny the useful tools at our hands in order to get resolution. So I think the issues that you raise have to be addressed, and they can be. In fact, in the discussions that I've had, and I've had many discussions in Iran over the past 6 or 7 years, at conferences and at small meetings with Iranian officials and various groups of the kind that you just described, you can get somewhere. You can get an understanding of the impact it has on Iran's position in the world. You can get an understanding of what their motivations might be, or what it would take to have such things stopped. So I'd say the first step in dealing with these very pertinent questions is to get right at it and sit down at the negotiating table and say, these are our list of problems, and what is your list, to get started with no preconditions and say, let's get at it, and let's resolve these things. There's no question in my mind that Iran, as the most powerful nation in the region, is not going to go away. And for most of our mutual experience, that is, from 1850 until now, Iran has been a close ally of ours. And we have many, many friends inside of Iran that admire the United States and what the United States and the West represent as a culture, as civilization. The best thing that we can do is meet with each other and treat each other with respect as human beings and get down to solving the questions that divide us. So I welcome you're raising these issues, and the best way to deal with them, I submit, is to face them intelligently and in the spirit of trying to resolve them in a way that can meet the objectives of both countries.
Can I follow up with one comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it? I wonder, and I'll pose this question to you: has there been a paradigm shift in Iran, so that at least among the Islamic Revolutionary Guard and those who see the Islamic Revolution as a new paradigm in Iran's point of view, that their perspective is such that the Shiite Islamic ideology trumps other Iranian interests? And especially with the call it millennial perspective of the president Ahmadinejad and others, that this might lead them to do things, whether it's in terms of suicide terrorism or other things, which frankly will lead to bloodshed and violence, despite the fact that there are connections.
Well, this is a very important question, and I would say that as someone who has been to Iran frequently and has been a student of it for 40 or 50 years, that yes, there are people who have an extreme view, but if you look at the clergy, and this is a heavily a clerical state, you find a tremendous range of attitude and political militancy. When the revolution was taking place, almost everyone in the clergy were involved in changing the regime, getting the Shah out and cleansing the state from their point of view and having a fresh start as a religious duty. And now there is a majority shift in clerical thinking that it's time for the clergy to go back to the seminaries and to the mosques and do their normal work. But the rulers of Iran are still senior clergy, and they are from the revolutionary generation, although they have moderated without question. And the younger generation of clerics, highly educated, are much in the line of the former president, Khatami. And there's certainly a belief in tolerance, the attitude that there are many paths to God, that God has many houses, and it's one's religion depends on where one is born, and that all of the great religions have common purpose, and that the great religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, all have peace as a central proposition, and that we're looking for a life of reason and decency. In order to deal with the question of Shia militancy, which certainly exists, one has to engage it. And you'll find that among the Shia clergy, and I know many of them, they're among the world's most educated human beings. You know, their studies, as many senior religious people, is to study not only their own religious works for 20 or 30 years, but all of the great works of human accomplishment. So they know a lot about not only their own jurisprudence, but they know about the jurisprudence throughout the world. They know the history of the world. In Qom, at several of the seminaries, they have courses on contemporary politics and science, if you can grasp that. So you're not dealing with an abstract a world that's cut off intellectually. They're open and deeply highly trained in Aristotelian logic and other forms of logic, and they can handle the toughest intellectual questions, but you have to engage. You know, that's the great gift of humanity, is to be able to talk and reason and settle problems if they occur.
We are just a bit past the midpoint here. I want to thank the caller, and I have a couple of others I want to get to, and also for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in here recently, I'd better introduce again our guest, Ambassador William Miller. He is a senior policy fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 1993 until 1998. Before that, in the early 60s, he served as political officer for the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and the U.S. consulate in Isfahan. He spent 15 years on Capitol Hill, where he served as staff director for three different Senate committees, including the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He's been following the politics of the Middle East and Iran, particularly, for quite a long time now, and is also head of the Iran Project at the Search for Common Ground, which is an attempt to improve relations between the two countries by working at building contacts person to person. Between various kinds of individuals in the two countries. And we're talking about the relationship between Iran and the United States. And questions certainly welcome. We have a couple of here who are standing by and ready to go. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm interested in your opinion on the recent congressional enactment of exemption for India, even though they didn't sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and how this would affect conversations about nuclear weapons with Iran. Thank you.
Well, this is an example of inconsistency in the minds of many. But India is a friend of the United States, and the notion that it goes further that India, as a great power, the world's largest population, or first or second with China, that it has a special place in the world, and that if the NPT were being started now, India would have a place as a nuclear power because it's a great power. Other nations don't see it that way, and they immediately recognize the inconsistency that how can you have a regime in which nations voluntarily give up nuclear weapons if you sign on and you get benefits, there are nations that remain outside the regime, like India and Israel. And why should they be treated differently? And while people who are signatories are treated badly because they don't have good relations with the great powers. So it raises tremendous issues. And the United Nations context, the IAEA, which is the nuclear energy and non-proliferation context, are the places to settle these differences between nations that don't always agree on all issues, or in some cases agree on very few, and still you try and achieve some kind of agreement. The India case is just an example of how complicated it is. And nonetheless, we've managed to work out a more or less acceptable regime that's a limited proliferation, a dangerous proliferation, and we hope that we can muddle through and keep it at as low a level as possible.
Well, again, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go on to Thomasboro. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to try and take a perspective looking from the Iranians outside and
yes.
And given some things. First off, given that you saw that the U.S. was actively involved with the Shah and trying to mess with the government of Iran for years and years and years, then when during the Iranian-Iraq war, okay, during the 80s, the United States military, the U.S. Army very specifically, provided the chemical and biological munitions that were used against Iran by Iraq, those came from our stockpiles, and Fort Thule Army Munitions Depot and all over the place, then given that when Gulf War I, the U.S. baited and switched, did a lot of baiting and switching to get Iraq to go into Kuwait, which they then did over the oil, to get troops into the region, and then given that we invaded Afghanistan based on a February 12, 1998 directive to overthrow the Taliban, congressional directive, that's where the military plan came from because of the oil situation, and then now going into Iraq on this invasion based without justification. And then finally, that the fact that the U.S. has a very active nuclear weapons program and many bunker busters and everything that they're actually testing now at the Nevada test site, why would the Iranians even consider that the U.S. would possibly be peaceful towards them with the last thing that the U.S. military is actively planning, an invasion? So I guess the question I'm asking is, why would the Iranians have any reason to trust the U.S. given all the events that have actually transpired and really occurred?
Well, that's a very useful perspective. I think the reason why is there are many in the Iranian leadership and among Iranian intellectuals who not only have studied in the United States and value what they learned there and still have extensive contacts with the United States. They believe that for all of its faults from their point of view and all of the mistakes that it's made in the Middle East from their point of view, still having a decent relationship with the United States is a good idea, not only because United States is the most powerful nation in the world, but because there are many benefits to be had with a good relationship. So I would say that there's a belief that our country, the United States, still has and certainly has much to offer other countries in the world, and they understand that. And they're willing, on a basis of mutual respect, to come to understandings of how they can live with each other. Iranian oil and gas is very important to the world economy. Certainly the benefits of the thousands of years of Iranian civilization are of benefit to world civilization. And the long record of relationships between the United States and Iran overall has been a good one. Our assistance programs to Iran from the earliest days of our missionaries in the 19th century through the Point Four and aid programs up until the revolution are examples of our working together in a very constructive way. We did a lot of positive things in Iran, and I witnessed them. And the Iranians remember this and live with it every day because there are monuments throughout the country of our efforts. There are the dams that were built, the power lines, many of the facilities in universities and hospitals. These are the result of our cooperation. So there are lots of reasons, positive reasons, why we should cooperate. And there are lots of negative things that have happened, but the way to resolve the issues created by those negative things is by face-to-face talks. But I think you're very wise to bring up the other side of the equation. It's something that many people don't know.
Do you have a hope and a dream that the administration and the Council on Foreign Relations, who drives all that, will make a change such that we can go back into a peaceful dialogue?
Yeah, I think so. And there's a recognition because of the experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, and of course our previous long history of working closely together. Number one, we were assisted extensively by the Iranians in Afghanistan. They sought our help, and that the Iranians gave it. For example, in protecting the air base at Bagram when our forces first went in against the Taliban. The Taliban are also enemies of Iran, so they have a common interest, and there were in fact negotiations between Americans and Iranians on that question. In Iraq, which is, as you know, there was an 8-year war in which there were a million casualties, and there's no natural alliance between Iraq and Iran, even though there are the Shia share a religion, but they are different people. They have a different cultural history, even though in many respects they share a cultural history. So there are many reasons why the United States and Iran should cooperate. Number one, Iran is the major player in the region. And in the past, we supported Iran as in the time of the Shah. Iran was called the linchpin of stability in the Middle East. And this was a recognition of an ally, but it was also the most powerful nation. And it's still the most powerful nation. And any regional arrangement in the Middle East would have to take account of Iran, either as a part of the regional security or as a threat. And Iran has been working for many years to solve its differences with its Arab neighbors. And they, for their own domestic reasons of oil and gas sales, they want stability in the region. They want trade and commerce between the countries, and there are many reasons why they want to work in harmony rather than in conflict. So I think there are very valid reasons for thinking that the one outcome of the end of the war in Iraq will be regional stability, which will include the position of Iran as one of the major players.
Let me just take it a step further, because I think the caller is suggesting something interesting by saying, let's look at it from the perspective of the Iranians. I think now that for some time people have been looking forward to the release of this report by the Iraq Study Group. This is this commission headed by James Baker and Lee Hamilton.
Yeah.
And that one of the things that we've been expecting for a long time that they would recommend is that the solution in Iraq has to involve both Iran and Syria, and there's going to have to be direct talks. And I think there are a lot of other people have said the same thing. Tony Blair has said it. A lot of other people have said it. And there are other things that we think that the Iranians can help us with. They can help us with Iraq. They could perhaps rein in Hezbollah in Lebanon. We want them to open their nuclear program. So we have this list of things we'd like to get from Iran. And I'm sure on the other side, the Iranians have a list of things they would like in exchange. You know, they're not going to they're going to expect some reciprocity. So here my question is, well, what's on the Iranians' list? What would they be looking for, looking to get in the process of improving the bilateral relationship?
No, this is a good question. And for the past 5 or 6 years, groups, including ones that I've been working with, have gone over these agendas. I mean, these are non-governmental groups, but they include people who have had experience in government, as I have, and who know the issues. And on the Iranian side, counterparts, but it also has included people from the Iranian government. And the agendas are well understood on both sides of what the outstanding issues are. On the Iranian side, they would like the lifting of sanctions, which extend back to the beginning of the Iranian Revolution. There is a frozen assets that have been frozen since that time that amount to many billions that are owed to Iran. It's the lifting of embargoes on aircraft. Commercial aircraft, replacement of Boeings in their air fleet. It's the restrictions on equipment for the development and maintenance of their oil and gas fields and distribution systems. It's many curbs on normal trade, and we have blocked their entry into international trade organizations. So it's allowing Iran to take its normal place in the world of commerce and economics is first on their agenda. The other is, perhaps most important to them, is a matter of dignity, is to be treated as a nation with a sovereign nation with its own rights and dignities, as an equal partner in the United Nations and as a partner in international organizations. And I think in the end, they would like to, as they already are, even in these difficult times, very much involved in the oil and gas trade throughout the world, which affects us very directly at the gas pump. They would like to share with us the joint ventures and in every field, not only business and commerce, but in education, science, technology, and bringing in the benefits of civilization to their people. So I think they would like to be treated as a nation of sovereignty with the respect that we would accord to any nation.
Let's take one more call. We do have one more. I want to make sure that we get them in. We have about 5 minutes left. The caller is in Kankakee, line number 4. Hello.
It would appear as though the military adventure of the President of the United States in Iraq has been unwittingly working to the benefit of Iran, by destabilizing Iraq and strengthening Iran's position in the region. How, if it is possible, might Iran return the favor and be of assistance to the United States and the international community in undoing the damage the President of the United States has been doing in Iraq? Thank you.
That's a very pertinent question. It's very much what is under consideration in our government, and I'm sure in the Baker-Hamilton Commission and in Congress and in Iran. There have been discussions, informal discussions, with the Iranians about how they could help. They have helped considerably. And, of course, the Shia connections are one way in which stability can be brought to Iraq and the region, just as the converse can also be the case. But the major Iraqi Shia leader, Ali Sistani, is someone who believes in peace. He is opposed to the extremist approach. And I think that's the major position of the Shia clergy on both sides of the border. Obviously, the government of Iran can help, and it's in its own interest to have a stable Iraq. Even though it was the victim of invasion from Iraq and a 8-year war with tremendous loss of life and property, so they want stability. They see that they have a major role to play, and they intend to play it. And the issue is, in what constructive ways can Iran and the United States assure regional stability? Our attitude up until now has been to exclude Iran from the equation of any formal stability arrangements, and to treat Iran as a pariah with no right to any interests in Iraq. I mean, the Iranians, of course, believe that they have more direct interest in Iraq than the United States does, since it's on its border, and since they were a victim of gas and chemical attacks and missile attacks from Saddam Hussein, who was assisted by the United States during that war.
We're just about the point where we have to finish. Quickly, let me ask you this question. As we've been talking about here about the possibility of improving relations between the two countries and having peaceful and stable relations, and that certainly being desirable as far as a lot of people are concerned. At the same time, it seems to me, as I read about this relationship, there is still a bit of saber-rattling going on in Washington, D.C., and it would appear that there are some people who hold on to the idea that to rein in what they consider to be Iran's inappropriate nuclear ambitions, that some kind of military action is going to be necessary. And there are apparently people who expect that sometime between now and the time that George Bush leaves office, that that's going to happen. What do you hear, and what do you think is the likelihood that such a thing would happen? Or maybe the question is, how much support do you think there would be in Washington for such a thing?
Well, I think the congressional elections have changed the equation considerably. The understanding of what our electorate has asked for is an end to the war in Iraq and an end to the violence. And to pay attention to the major outstanding issues, there has to be a revival of serious discussions between the Palestinians and the Israelis to settle that issue that lies at the heart of so many of the problems in the Middle East. And there hasn't been much effort made in the past 6 years. So that is certainly one important element that will come of all of this. But the most important thing is to get the major contenders, the major participants those who have the power and the grievances to talk together to work out solutions. And that's what's been missing. And I think the recommendations that will be coming will be to engage. The time of the, I'd say, the hawkish point of view that if you see a threat, nuke it or bomb it or attack it before it becomes something larger. The failure of that approach is already evident.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that there's much credibility now. There was, certainly was before the congressional elections, but the outcome of the congressional elections has changed the equation considerably.
We're going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. Ambassador Miller, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it very much.
Ambassador William Miller is a senior policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's a former ambassador to Ukraine, and in the late 50s to the early 60s, early to mid-60s, he also had a couple of postings in Iran. He was U.S. Political officer for the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and was also at the U.S. Consulate in Isfahan, Iran. Spent 15 years also on Capitol Hill serving as a staff director for three different Senate committees, including the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence.